most of Augustine's arguments relative to Christianity were derived from the poison Roman pen of Paul. The fulcrum of his worldview pivots on removing the millennial presentation found in Revelation 20 and 21, which, by the way, are not extant in any pre-Constantine manuscripts, from Yahusha's prophetic letters. So, you know, Yahusha in Revelation 2 and 3, which is extant in many pre-Constantine manuscripts, is an open letter specifically condemning the church age, and in particular Roman Catholicism. So to build a theology on Revelation 20 and 21, you have to remove it from Revelation 2 and 3. And then you also have to remove it from Yahusha's explanation of Daniel 7 through 9 that is found in Revelation 12 through 19. Revelation 12 through 19 is a paraphrase and explanation of Daniel 7 through 9. And so you have to essentially remove it from the entirety of Revelation, because, you know, the beast of Revelation 12 through 19 is Rome, and particularly the Roman Catholic Church. So, you know, Constantine's basing his city of God on the same way that Paul did. You know, you take something out of context and you spin it to represent the antithesis of what it actually says. So as a result, the second half of his book is a romp through the make-believe world of religion. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, I knew you had mentioned Alexander Hislop, the two Babylons. And
right.
It's like almost every pastor I know has at some time encountered or read that book. And
right.
What they apparently take from it is just enough to create some sense of cognitive dissonance about the church and its affiliation with Rome. But it rarely produces a thoroughgoing examination of Paul or of the church.
Right.
You know, it rarely motivates them to deal with the problems of syncretism in the church in this marriage to Babylon.
Right. Yes, as a matter of fact, I'm glad you mentioned Hislop, who is the author of The Two Babylons. The biggest issue I have with The Two Babylons is that it assails Roman Catholicism as being Babylonian, and it is. Its theology is almost resolutely Babylonian. But what it does not recognize, Hislop did not recognize that almost every aspect of Babylon was also manifest in the religion of Christianity, even when practiced by a Protestant. And so he was unable to see the influence of the Babylonian mythology and religion in Protestant Christianity. So he only directed his attacks to the Roman Catholic Church without seeing the rest of it. And the other thing that is troubling about the book, it's just difficult. The reason I don't recommend people read The Two Babylons is that what it attempts to do is to trace all of the Babylonian gods and their names through their Egyptian manifestations, through their Greek manifestations, through their Roman manifestations, to how those gods are manifest now in Christianity. And that whole process, it's somewhere along the line you're just going to say, all right, I'm confused already.
I got it with the first pantheon. You know, if you just know that the Romans just took the Greek pantheon
right.
and renamed them, and
right.
the Celts then followed. It's the same story
right.
over and over.
Yeah, it's always the Queen of Heaven and the Mother of God gets impregnated by the father of the gods, and she gives birth to a god who is both god and man, fully god, fully man. That god-man is killed violently, and he is resurrected, and that story always occurs where he is born on the winter solstice, and he is killed on Easter Sunday. The story, as it progresses through Tammuz being the first, Osiris, Dionysus, and Bacchus, is the Christian Jesus.
Right.
So that part of it's easy to follow.
Right. Well, the problem is if you go. I had a problem a few years ago with the writings of a woman who uses the pen name Acharya S., her name's Diane Murdoch, and she's like sort of from Albert Churchward and those folks who say that like everything is about the solar phallic cultus. It's, you know, that these kind of connections to Bacchus, Dionysius, and all that, these are all there. But then they say that anytime you see a hero surrounded by his 12 followers, whether it's Jason and the Argonauts, or it's Hercules and his 12 labors, or they'll even say that it is Jacob become Israel with his 12 sons, or Jesus with his 12 disciples, and they say it's all the same solar mythos. And that, you know, that's a challenge, you know, a challenge even to ones believe in Yahweh. And then you have to sort the babies on the bathwater to find Yahusha again. And Yahweh.
Right. Yes, like those who claim that the Gilgamesh epic in ancient Babylon is the basis of Noah and the flood story. Well, yes, there was a flood in both stories. However, 99.9% of the story of the Gilgamesh epic differs from the presentation of Noah and the flood. I mean, it's they intersect less than 0.1%, and they are disassociated 99.9%. So to make the connection and say they are the same, which is done in scholarly theology, is just it's a point made out of complete ignorance. And so, yes, to say that there are the sun god phallic mythologies that are promoted by throughout time is true. But then just to say that because there are 12 tribes of Yisrael and Yosha had 12 disciples, that therefore just because there are 12, that those are the same.
Right.
It strikes me as the same kind of
thing. Yeah, and that can be the hard. I mean, these people have some success with this, you know, version of this.
Yes,
I mean,
they do.
I really had to work through that. To say, wait a minute, no. Yahusha is a historical personage, and Yahweh is I am real.
Right.
And no, I'm sorry, this is different than what you are saying.
Yes.
You know, it's more.
And by the way, that's the critical issue is you took the time to get to know the facts. You examined the evidence, and based upon the evidence, you used reason to disassociate those things which should not have been associated. That's not easy to do. It takes time, and it takes a rational mind, and it takes a willingness to make connections between facts.
And it was painful. That was a hard challenge. Yeah. You know, and it was like, whoa, you know, is this solar cultus really so pervasive? You know, and then you have to say, wait, no, Yahweh Israel.
No, Israel. Yeah. Now, is the solar cult pervasive? Absolutely. Does it infect Judaism? Absolutely. Christianity? With absolute certainty. Did it permeate the religion of Babylon? Yes. And also Persia, and also Egypt, and also Alexander, and also Rome. And it still is manifest in the Roman Catholic Church to an excessive degree. All of that's true. But then if you then try to include Yahweh and Yahusha, what you find is that their positions are the antithesis of the solar cult.
I'd like to make a couple hits on comments and then go because I'm exceedingly busy and I have to run. I wanted to, about the Bo Bergdahl thing. Bo Bergdahl may not know baseball, but he's sure learning politics very fast at the moment, I'm sure.
Well, he did.
And he did. And the UN is prisoner exchange. The U.S., you know, has so many spin doctors involved that the Muslims had to bring in Sufi whirling dervishes just to keep up.
Boy, do we ever. I mean, this is such a disastrous move on behalf of the United States. Even the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for the U.S. military, the top general for the U.S., a four-star general, says, yeah, you know, we're probably going to have to prosecute him when he comes back for going AWOL. And so he's going to go from what really was a nice prison where he got to, you know, drink tea and play badminton to a U.S. military prison.
Right, right. Now, did you, I don't know, did you hear the story on the break where they were kind of hemming and hawing. It's like, well, it's really just not helping anybody to accentuate that. It's essentially stuff on him and his family. It sounds to me like they're going to give him a pass. Give him a good debriefing and a pass, you know.
Yeah, but you see, if they give him a pass, then what does it do to the next person that wants to go AWOL?
Well, it reinforces the notion of going on the other side. Just give in. Yeah, become a John McCain.
By the way, they're really in a horrible position here, because if they don't prosecute him, then there is no credibility to their ability to hold people accountable in the military, to where you have no free will. But if they hold him accountable, then they're going to promote the truth, which is that if you join the military, you have relinquished your free will and your freedom. And so if they push this, then people will know what they're getting into if they sign up for the military, is that is that they have surrendered their life.
Right. And if you get captured, just collaborate with the enemy, and they'll make you senator later on. Let's see, one other thing I was going to say. I hear you about the economy. How do these economists live with themselves or sleep at night? It's everything's fine. Everything's going up roses. It's like, oh my God, you're such liars.
Of course. You know, if the president, of course, that job description requires him to deceive and to tell everybody that, yes, I've got the economy back robust and flourishing again. What's been interesting, of course, on all of the prognostications on the economy is that they'll come out and say, hey, this is better. And then you'll read down in the article a little further, and they'll say, you know, there were fewer claims for unemployment. Well, then you'd find that, well, there were fewer claims because the vast majority of people simply gave up looking for jobs, and you can't file for unemployment when you give up looking for a job. Or they'll say that there were 250,000 jobs added, and then the next month they'll say, well, that really wasn't the right number. It was 50,000 jobs added. And then you read down a little further in the article, and they'll say, well, actually, you know, it's not just that 50,000 jobs were added. Those were the new jobs. We, at the same time, we lost 400,000 jobs, for a net loss of 450,000 jobs. So every time you actually study what they say, they're lying, and they want you to believe into the myth. It is telling that Augustine, like Paul, was a Gnostic. Just as Paul's letters present the Gnostic view of the spirit and the flesh, with one being good, the other being evil, the actual city of Rome is contrasted with a spiritual construct, the city of God. The Augustine, in this case, was heavily influenced by the original version of Gnosticism that was founded by the prophet Mani Sasanian in Babylon. His elitist philosophical belief system thrived during Augustine's lifetime, especially between the 3rd and 7th centuries, where it was not only widespread and as influential as Christianity at the time, the religions became so similar, Gnosticism was amalgamated into Christianity. And this explains Augustine's fascination with Plato, the Greek scholar who popularized Gnosticism amongst intellectuals. Since Augustine's City of God, second only to Paul's letters, is the most influential text in developing Christianity, it should also be noted that Augustine was wrong in developing the doctrine of being enslaved to original sin, along with the doctrine of grace, as the only means to freedom. His doctrine of the Trinity was purely Babylonian. His doctrine of the millennium was completely Gnostic. While Augustine's errors continue to haunt Christianity, the least known is his views on the millennium, which may be the most troubling. His projected prophetic timeline of the last days on earth, which is still prevalent in the most prevalent Christian view anyway, is that the millennial celebration of Sukkah and the Shabbat, which he would not associate with either of those two terms, although that's what it is wholly invalid. It's wrong in nature, wrong in time, wrong in place, wrong in purpose. This perspective, which is the antithesis of Yahweh's promise, was advanced because Augustine was opposed to the Shabbat. He was opposed to the Mikra. He was opposed to the Torah. He was opposed to the covenant. He was opposed to Yahweh's 6+1 formula and to what Jerusalem and Eden represent. With Augustine, all of these things were replaced by the Roman Catholic Church, making them irrelevant. You know, in Augustine's mind, the millennium had already begun and was synonymous with the advent of Roman Catholicism. Much of the City of God paints paganism and Christianity as black and white, as good versus evil. Yet in reality, as Glenn has mentioned on numerous occasions, most every material aspect of Christianity and the religion has pagan roots. The Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox Church grew through syncretism by combining complementary and contradictory mythologies that were practiced and accepted by the different cultures the church wanted to assimilate, wanted to influence and control. And while Augustine was a Catholic apologist, his affinity for predestination made him a favorite of Calvinists and therefore many Protestants. He even became a saint with his feast day celebrated on June 15th. And since for many, much of his life, he was a hedonist and a bisexual libertine, as Glenn mentioned, you know, a lot of his writings are his overall challenge of how he would overcome his sexual issues. He and his City of God have become quite popular again in academia. You know, it should also be noted that his conversion experience occurred while reading Paul's attack on the flesh in the midst of his letter to the Romans. As an interesting insight into this unique slice of history during Christianity's formative years, it was Constantine who sent an early Christian theologian and historian, Orosius, to what Constantine called Palestine, because he bought into the Hadrian myth, the Roman myth, to meet with Jerome in Bethlehem, the author and translator of the Roman Catholic Church's Latin Vulgate. The intent of the trip was to undermine Augustine's most effective foe, Pelagius, who recognized that Augustine's promotion of original sin and predestination were absurd. Augustine wanted Pelagius to be declared a heretic, thereby demeaning the man, since Augustine could not refute Pelagius' arguments. And that is because Pelagius consistently cited the Torah to prove that his assessment was consistent with God's testimony, noting the fact that Pelagius relied expressly on the testimony of God in the Torah and prophets. I love his retort to his critic. He says, "Who is Augustine to me?" We'll return and consider Shavuot when we commence the next segment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We are going to move on to our presentation of Shavuot. This is celebrated today. Yes, go ahead, Glenn.
May I make one more aside and then...
Sure.
Amos?
Yeah, okay.
You were talking about... I don't know. One minute you're defending Arius, the next minute you're defending Pelagius. You are an incorrigible heretic, you know.
Exactly.
I was also going to say, in terms of Gnosticism, you have the modern saintling tables. You know, most modern, most modern evangelicals are schooled to, you know, refute her. The liberals are a little more honest about that. But the whole thing with Gnosticism has to do, and Arius all has to do with the relationship between spirit and matter,
Correct.
You know,
correct.
In modern physics, we would say matter and energy, you know, in the modern farmland.
Plato wrote about it extensively. Plato is really the guy that that popularized it amongst the intelligentsia. But,
Aristotle gave it one thing, I'm trying to wrap this up in Christianity had a tendency to subsume other stuff, other syncretize and blend in other religions around it. If you look at the Mithras cult that grew up at the same time as Gnosticism, and then Christianity, if you marry the Mithras cult to Gnosticism and change the bull to a sheep, a lamb, then you pretty much have
Christianity. You do. Yeah, it's amazing how similar Mithraism is to the Jesus character and to Christianity as a whole. And there really is no differentiation between Gnosticism and Paul's letters. And since Paul's letters form the basis of Christianity, it's all very true. And by the way, it does tie in to Arius because it was the Arius is the person that has had the most influence that nobody even knows who he is, and no one even understands that the Council of Nicaea was specifically designed to refute Arius so that the Christian religion could be established. Without refuting him, there was no way to establish the Christian religion. And, so it is it's an extraordinarily important moment in world history that almost no one seems to know, and even the very thing called the Nicene Creed. Nicaea was named after the Greek god of victory, Nike, and so it's the it's the victorious creed of the Greek religion. The whole thing is just really stinky and yet very few people recognize it.
In the whole spirit matter thing, it's almost impossible to overemphasize the significance of the spirit matter dichotomy. It's really, really hugely important to realize that in Judaism, Yahweh is very much the creator of the material world, and he pronounced it good. He pronounced his creation good. That totally militates against Gnosticism completely.
Yeah. By the way, while it's true that Yahweh calls the material world good, and Yahweh has no issue with the material world, so God's view is not Gnostic. It's the antithesis of Gnostic.
Exactly.
Paul's view is Gnostic, which makes it the antithesis of Yahweh's view. The interesting thing in Judaism is that Gnosticism exists in Judaism through Kabbalah. And so Kabbalah is the Pauline version, really, of Judaism. And so they do have their Gnostic approach as well. And as a matter of fact, Gnosticism, Kabbalah, is interwoven into Jewish thought. Most rabbis are absolutely fluent in Gnosticism through Kabbalah.
Right. And you drift up into Spiritism, you know you're drifting away from Yahweh. Anyway,
yes.
And one last parting shot as they walk out the door. And this is now for something totally different, just briefly, but amusing. Regarding the letter J, which you point out wasn't come into use until the 1600s, the Christians with the word Jesus aren't the only ones who have a J problem. There's certainly the people who refer to themselves as Jewish or Jew have a J problem. And ironically enough, I know how much you love dating services.
Right.
But I saw a commercial the other day for the dating service called J Date, which just kind of really is kind of accentuates the non-existent letter as being associated with a specifically Jewish dating service.
There's the problem with the J replacing the Y in Hebrew and the J replacing the I in both the Greek language and also in Latin is pervasive. Part of the problem with Judaism and Jews and Jerusalem and all of their replacement J's is really deliberate. They wanted to disassociate from things that are Hebrew. They wanted to disassociate from Yahweh, and they chose to associate with other identities, and as those identities change, it was not King James, it was King Iams. It wasn't he wasn't Julius Caesar, he was Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
And so as these things developed, the Jews wanted to disassociate from their past. They disassociate from Yahweh, and this helped them do it.
So we can be like the other nations.
Yeah, it goes all the way back to Saul, doesn't it? Yeah, we can have this really tall, handsome, strong guy as our king. We'll be just like the other nations, and that's what they've become. So, Jew is actually now an appropriate term, even though it has no scriptural basis.
Wow. Well, on that unusual. I better go and get out of your hair.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Glenn. All right, so we're returning to what God had to say about Shavua. We find it in Kara called out, which is Leviticus 23, where we began, we ended yesterday in the 16th verse. So let's continue on from there. It says, always and forever you should accurately count, reckon, record, relate, rehearse, regale the day of 50, starting from the next day after the seventh Shabbat. And you should choose without reservation to come near and to approach the renewing, restoring, and affirming gift to approach Yahweh. Now, there is one aspect of this that is challenging. The rest of it is really quite clear. One is that as it relates to the timing of this celebration, as it relates to these invitations to meet with God, of which there are seven, that God is saying that here, and this is his own voice, always and forever. Always and forever. And there is an accurate day. And he's talking about this is calling it the day of 50 because Shavua is seven sevens plus one. And the timing mechanism that begins it is the Shabbat. And it's the Shabbat that is part of unyeasted bread. Unyeasted bread has two Shabbat that happen to be part of it. There's a first one and a second one, but it commences and its primary Shabbat is on the first day of unyeasted bread. That's the second of 3 days in succession that play out. Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim, which are the three most important days in human history as Yahusha fulfilled these various events. And so they are tied together in this way. So it's an accurate way of regaling them, of counting them, of considering them. Now, since there are two Shabbats associated with Matzah, one the first day, one the seventh day, there are those who celebrate this feast a week from now. And, you know, I'm not going to argue with those who do so, but as I look at the totality of what God had to say, it certainly seems to me to be, if we were to go seven sevens from Bukurim, which was is the day after the Shabbat of Matzah, and apply the seven sevens to it, we end up with a far more consistent timing for the celebration of this Mikra. Now, beyond that, we move to the realization that God says that this is the means that we should use to choose to approach him. And we should do so without reservation and without interruption, and that we come near and approach him. Karab. That this is what we should want to do of our own volition without hesitation. It was written in the Hifl perfect consecutive. And that when we celebrate this day, Shavua, that it is about the receiving of a renewing and restoring gift. That renewing and restoring gift is the set apart spirit. And that gift is designed to approach Yahweh. So as is the case, the unique nature of Hebrew tenses can open up the floodgates of understanding. Written in the perfect conjugation and the consecutive form, Karab must be rendered, at least to be wholly accurate, you should choose, without reservation or interruption, to come near and approach. And you have a limited amount of time to make this choice. Anything written in the perfect is not ongoing. There's a very finite period of time in which this choice needs to be made. So you have a finite amount of time to make the choice to come near and approach. Because the consecutive denotes volition, while the perfect depicts a completed action. It is the Hifl stem which is the most intriguing. It means that we, as the subject of this sentence, cause Yahweh, as the object, to respond and participate in the specific action of the verb, which is to approach and come near. God, therefore, can be found near those who choose to approach him. God responds to those who approach him. It's another way of saying it. God reaches out to those who reach out to him. Now, moving on to the next curious term, kadash, which I translated renew and restore, is a very important term. It is the term that Yahweh uses in Yahshua 31 to describe the reaffirmation, the renewal of his covenant. It is a covenant, by the way, that has not yet been renewed, so there is no such thing as a New Testament, much less a new covenant. Now, in this light, more times than not, kadash, which is customarily and commonly deployed to depict the renewal of the sun's reflected life on the surface of the moon, it is almost always translated renew, restore, and reaffirm far more often than new. As we continue to consider what Yahweh is talking about here in terms of his commitment to renew, restore, and reaffirm us, that he's never speaks of making us new. You know, we are renewed. Our soul goes on. We don't get a new soul. We don't even get a new spirit. The spirit has existed longer than the universe has existed. Spirit's not new. Our soul's not new. Our soul is reaffirmed with the reaffirming spirit. This is how we are renewed. So in this instruction, Yahweh is speaking of his covenant's ability to renew us and of his restoring gift for all mankind, which is Pesach, Matzah, and Bukodim. He is asking us to approach him by way of the path he has prescribed in the Torah and laid out through Passover, unyeasted bread and firstborn children. By walking along this path, we come so close to God that we are enveloped in the set-apart spirit of Shavuah. That is why Shavuah is Yahweh's vow or promise which attests to our innocence, is how the word itself is defined. By stating that this feast is Yahweh's renewing gift, God is connecting the elements which comprise his plan all together for us. He has obliterated the myth that there is a distinction between his Torah instructions and his mercy. Yeah, Yahusha came to fulfill the Torah because Yahweh's guidance provides the way home. And that is perhaps why in this context of a renewing gift, God concluded this instruction with La Yahweh, that it's designed to enable us to approach Yah. Later in the Devarim, which has been corrupted to Deuteronomy, Moshe will tell us that the Mikra of Shavuah, this invitation to be called out and meet with God of 50, the promise of the Shabbat, is an all-inclusive affair. Men and women, young and old, wealthy and poor, slave and free. Goyim and Yehudim. Now, that foreknowledge is required to understand this text, especially in conjunction with the approach of Yahweh's restoring and renewing gift, as it is reflected in this commentary. Also, interesting, the word which consistently underlies man's errant choice of church in the Greek text is ecclesia. It means called out. It's relevant here because ecclesia is a reasonable translation of mikra. Shavuah, like the other seven mikra, is an invitation to be called out and meet with God. Ecclesia is simply a translation of mikra. It does not mean church. Yahusha has mikra, and in the plural, mikrae. The ecclesia is a translation of that concept. And these are invitations to be called out and meet with God. Now, while the Greek is but a pale reflection of the Hebrew, the Greek term just means called out, and the Hebrew term means a great deal more. It speaks of an invitation to be called out and to meet, and to do so by reading and reciting. So, you know, there's a huge difference between the terms. One is far richer than the other. But nonetheless, Ecclesia is the closest Greek translation there is of Mikra. And when Ecclesia has replaced church, something that God does not have, that he is wholly opposed to, as opposed to Mikra, which God has, and he's wholly supportive of, people are led in the wrong direction. As a result, men copy editing and improperly rendering both the Hebrew and Greek, as a result of this, not one Christian in a million is aware of this connection, of this association, of this path to a relationship with Yahweh. So that begs the question, why did men, who claim to be serving God and to be trustworthy, alter and blur Yah's message? And in so doing, create a politicized and powerful institution based upon their corruption, their counterfeit. What is it that causes the founders of religions like Judaism, Christianity, Islam, and Mormonism to claim God's authority and then contradict God? Well, the answer is, of course, obvious. Those who support the religious establishment are coddled by it. They're enriched by it. They're empowered by it. And those who expose and condemn it, those who threaten it by revealing the truth, are crucified by it, slandered, and often tortured. We'll return after the news and commercial break and continue to speak of Shavuah.